Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 28th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. As always, we begin with an Edgar Steele update. The big news is that the trial has been postponed until March the 7th. That's 4 months of delay, for no apparent reason that anyone can determine. It's beginning to look like the U.S. attorney wants to avoid a public trial because they now have virtually no evidence except for the so-called tapes of Steele soliciting Larry Fairfax to kill his wife and mother-in-law. And of course there's Fairfax himself, who is by now so completely discredited by his own behavior that I suspect the feds don't dare produce him in a courtroom and on the record. My guess is that they want the extra 4 months to bring more pressure on Ed Steele to cop a plea, to publicly admit that something happened, anything, so as to let the FBI off the hook. Be interesting to see what kind of a deal they offer him, if we're ever allowed to learn that. Of course, it also gives them another 4 months wherein Steele's terrible health might kick in and solve the whole problem for them, with or without a little encouragement from the prison doctor. Bear in mind that 11 months ago, Steele underwent very serious open-heart surgery, and his health has to be pretty precarious still. Now, that's not something you just get up and walk away from. Anybody remember what happened to Jim McDougal in federal custody back in 1998 when it looked like he might break and his testimony before Ken Starr might have embarrassed Billy Boy? That will mean that by the time he comes to trial, if he ever does come to trial, the invalid and recovering cardiac patient Edgar Steele will have been in prison for 9 months for a crime which, it's becoming more and more clear every day, he did not commit. I won't even bother to ask what happened to the constitutional guarantee of a speedy trial. We're dealing with the government of the United States here, and they're allowed to ignore any and all sections of the Constitution as it pleases them. I mean, really, who's going to do anything about it? And how is anyone going to do anything about it? Vote Republican? We had 8 years to see how much good that did. The second item of news is that the federal judge has modified the no-contact order against Steele and his wife Cindy, his alleged victim. Well, sort of. Edgar Steele and Cindy Steele are now allowed to meet once a week in the Spokane County Jail, but they're not allowed to touch. They are not allowed to exchange any written notes or documents, and they're not allowed to say anything at all about the case. Steele's court-appointed attorney must be present at all times, and he is under court order to immediately suspend the meeting and have Steele hustled back to his cell if he doesn't like anything either husband or wife says. Finally, all of these meetings are to be recorded, and by order of the judge, the recording of each meeting is to be gone over with a fine-toothed comb by a federal magistrate and the FBI, in order to make sure that Cindy and Edgar aren't communicating in some kind of secret code. And no, I'm not making this up. I'm sorry if this seems to be rocking the boat at a time when Ed Steele needs all the support he can get, but I'm sorry, I simply don't believe that someone who is being paid by the very court system and the very government that has initiated this whole grotesque farce, and who are clearly determined to destroy Ed Steele out of what appears to be nothing more or less than sheer vindictive malice, is capable of representing Steele with the kind of single-minded and complete zeal which any attorney is supposed to devote to his client's interest. The fact that the judge appointed Steele's own ostensible attorney as the watchdog over these horrible government-supervised meetings tells the story, I think, as well as the fact that the judge assumes that this man who is supposed to be on Steele's side will enforce this atrocity without question. I have a really creepy vision in my mind as to what those meetings will be like. What the hell are husband and wife supposed to talk about in a situation like that? The weather? Moving right along here, I don't normally respond to inner nuts, but this one particular recent incident is of a nature that's happened on more than one occasion and which will presumably happen again, so I might as well discuss yet another one of those weird little dysfunctional movement phenomena that appeared with great regularity. And bear with me, guys, this does have a larger and entirely germane point, I assure you. I recently got a private message from one of the posters on our discussion forum, northwestrepublic.com, chastising me for my evil ways and renouncing the Northwest Imperative because I'm a horrid herald indeed, etc., etc. And it took me a while, but I finally figured out what he was talking about, I think. My horrible crime was one which I have to admit I'm guilty of at times and will probably be guilty of in the future, i.e. I didn't pay him sufficient attention online, and I didn't return his greetings to a Northwest Front member, as he described himself. Therefore, I am, in his words, not a leader, quote-unquote, which actually I would agree with. Specifically, this individual, whose actual name and whereabouts I don't know, challenged me to a long discussion on the group wherein he would condescend to reveal to me all of the flaws and failures and general nonsense in the Northwest idea. Possibly he had or still has some alternative plan to present to us, although other people have been responding to him on that thread and he hasn't revealed it yet if he does have one. Okay, a few things first. As a matter of policy, I myself post to northwestrepublic.com only occasionally. Now, the reason is that I want it to be a Northwest forum and not a Harold Covington forum. You guys already hear enough from me every week, not to mention my books and my blogs and whatnot. On northwestrepublic.com, I want to hear from you. I've tried to explain before what my own role in all this is, and I've also tried to explain that the Northwest Front does not have members, but I know a lot of people are having difficulty wrapping their minds around that. I won't go over it again now because there is actually another aspect to this problem that I've come across before on a fairly regular basis, and it's that I want to address. Basically, what I did to ruffle this character's feathers was I refused to conduct a long email debate with him over principles and issues which, in my opinion, are not only now completely beyond debating, but which have been gone over time and again in the past 50 years to the point of imbecility. I get this a lot, and I'm sure other movement personalities, as let's call them, get it a lot as well. There are those among us who have the idea that progress consists of sitting at our computers, well, these days anyway, or sitting at our typewriters, back in the old days of the envelope and the postage stamp, and writing long, long letters to one another, bitching and moaning and analyzing and pontificating and theorizing and quoting from ancient Roman statesmen and going over the same ground again and again and again. I am sure that at least some of you listening to this recognize the type of person I'm referring to. On more than one occasion, I've received proposals, or maybe they're propositions, from men who suggest that we form a quote-unquote committee of correspondence, which would apparently consist of some kind of quasi-intellectual circle jerk, wherein a small group of mostly middle-aged wannabes send each other long, long letters showing off how bloody brilliant they are. Letters which will never be read by any significant group or number of people, and which will have no effect at all on the ongoing Rocky Horror Picture Show we call America. Only nowadays it's all done by internet, of course. Now, there was recently yet another attempt to create such a circle jerk, a blog called the Jacksonian Club, although to give him credit, the man behind it had sense enough to realize that he was never going to get anywhere, and he packed it in after about 6 weeks of bloviating. Down through the years, you guys will have heard me rant and rave about these dumbass skinhead types who cover themselves with tattoos and run around getting drunk and starting bar fights and punching some nigger or smashing synagogue windows and going to prison for 10 years for hate crime. Well, this phenomenon I refer to is the opposite extreme from that. Our wild eyes and dysfunctionals have elevated doing the wrong thing into an art form. These quasi-intellectual types, on the other hand, that I'm talking about, have elevated doing nothing into a science. In addition to thoughtless, tattooed idiots and drunks who end up doing stupid things and making us all look stupid and insane in public, we also have a lot of narcissistic, wannabe intellectuals and shithouse philosophers in the movement who spend their lives churning out endless reams of wordage that nobody ever reads, trying to prove things that were already proven long ago, and which shouldn't require proof to our own people. And, of course, the Internet has been an absolute godsend to these pseudos. Okay, let me spell this out. First off, on a personal note, I admit that, yes, I am often slow in answering my 200 or so emails per day. And when I do answer them, more often than not, it's in the form of a kind of monosyllabic grunt, so at least the person does get some kind of acknowledgement. My comrade James is now trying to handle a lot of these emails for me, and I admit that thanks to his efforts, I'm starting to see some improvement in that situation. I'm keenly aware of the fact that I can accomplish nothing without your support, and I will never deliberately offend anyone of our own race who is clearly sincere in their intentions. But I'm dead serious, guys. I'm snowed under with email. And in addition to all that, I finally started the preliminary outline and research part of that Northwest novel number 5 everybody seems to want. So it's unavoidable that sometimes my response to your email is going to be kind of sparse. However, that having been said, there's more to it than mere lack of time. I simply refuse to keep on debating and arguing and expostulating and speechifying the same ideas and meeting the same objections and going over the same ground over and over again on a personal one-to-one basis with anybody and everybody who wanders in off the internet, especially if I have no idea on earth who you are or what your true agenda is. Now, for all I know, at least some of these guys who want to engage me in long, long debates or correspondence for their personal edification, they may be the holy rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Schmuck L, or one of Cass Sunstein's cognitive dissonance internet operatives who are trying to gather information and waste my time. I know that sounds paranoid, but just because you're paranoid don't mean they ain't out to get you. Sunstein's cognitive dissonance ops are very real. But it goes beyond that. It's not just that I don't have the time to defend the Northwest Imperative in some scholarly or not-so-scholarly email exchange or the comments section of some blog, but I don't have the inclination. I'm curious to know what this gentleman thought he was going to accomplish by trying to point out to me what he claimed were the flaws in the Northwest idea, all of which, by the by, I've already answered and refuted before, repeatedly. Did he think he was going to convince me that I was wrong and make me give up and join his committee of correspondence and spend the rest of my life sending him long, long emails? Look, guys, I concede that there are some practical objections to the Northwest migration and the Northwest independence idea, but they were all spelled out long ago, and I've done my best to answer them. In fact, I still do, usually every week on Radio Free Northwest, as well as having a stack of canned answers to every conceivable naysay and objection out the wazoo sitting here on my hard drive, ready to wend their way to this fellow at the speed of light. Now, some of them are nice and long and would give him all the bedtime reading he needs. If he is, in fact, sincere, I could probably persuade him that his objections are not insurmountable, but he won't give me his actual email address. Instead, he won't be satisfied with anything but a long exchange of public emails on the group, which, I have to say, looks a little odd. Now, this is not to say that I am unwilling to defend the Northwest migration or the Northwest front on the internet. Doing so is part of my job. But I intend to do so where it will actually do some good. For example, if I were given free and unmoderated access to VNN, Stormfront, or White News Now, I'd be chomping at the bit to debate the Northwest Imperative with Alex Linder or Don Black or Jamie Kelso. The trouble is that I would have to ask for a few basic ground rules. Like no Glenn Miller anywhere in sight since he's no longer one of us, and no quote-unquote creative editing of my posts or redacting of the party website URL. And we all know that ain't going to happen, especially with Linder. The Nikes who say V-Bulletin view us correctly as competition, and they're not going to let us Northwesters draw water from their well. But if the chance ever offered, I'd jump at it. VNN and Stormfront have a large readership, people the NF needs to reach. There would be a purpose to such a debate in such a case. Something tangible that would advance the cause of the 14 words. There is no point in my preaching to the choir on our own group. And there's something else, something that cuts even deeper. It's a matter of principle. One of the ways in which we have wasted the past 50 years is in exactly this kind of endless debate. On and on and on and on. And it's time for the talk to end. It is time for the endless contemplation of our navels to cease. It is time for the bottomless well of excuses we make up for doing nothing to dry up. It is time to act, and I don't mean by getting drunk in a bar and punching a nigger and going to prison, nor do I mean by you doing some silly illegal act that some smart Jewish U.S. attorney can huff and puff into a conspiracy case and take 8 or 10 other people with you. The act I refer to is the beginning of the road to the world of my novels in the NVA. It is the simple, legal, and ultimately personally beneficial act of packing a moving van and getting your ass up here. Right now, pretty much everything I do is in one way or another directed towards that end. And if something doesn't help eventually to produce physical people here in the Northwest, I'm not interested. First music break. Since it's almost Halloween, I thought I'd see what I could come up with by way of spooky or supernatural music. No, I'm not going to play Monster Mash. I hunted around for spooky or at least creepy music that still has some kind of Aryan, racial, or historical significance. There are, of course, classical pieces like Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, but that's too long for this show and probably a bit too egg-headed as well. I looked around on the internet for certain songs that I know, but I couldn't find a lot of them. Too obscure to be uploaded onto the net yet, I guess. I did come up with a few selections, though. This is an old ballad called Little Omi Wise, and it's based on actual events. A real murder that happened sometime around 1830 in Randolph County, North Carolina, just down the road from where I'm from. This is Doc Watson.
Oh, listen to my story, I'll tell you no lies. How John Lewis did murder poor little Omi Wise. He told her to meet him at Adams's Springs. Said he'd bring her money and other fine things. So fool-like she met him at Adams's Springs. No money he brought her, nor other fine things. Go with me, little Omi, and away we will go. Off to get married, and no one will know. Fingers are cold. She climbed up behind him and away they did go, but off to the river where deep waters flow. John Lewis, John Lewis, will you tell me your mind? Do you intend to marry me or leave me behind? Little Omi, little Omi, I'll tell you my mind. My mind is to drown you and leave you behind. Have mercy on my baby and spare me my life. I'll go home as a beggar and never be your wife. He kissed her and he hugged her, then he turned her around and pushed her in deep waters where he knew that she would drown. He jumped on his pony and away he did ride as the screams of little Omi went down by his side. Was on one Thursday morning the rain came pouring down, when the people searched for Omi, but she could not be found. Two boys went to fishing one fine summer day, and they saw little Omi's body go floating away. Then they threw their net around her and drew her to the bank. Her clothes all wet and muddy, they laid her on a plank. They sent for John Lewis to come to that place. And they brought her out before him so that he might see her face. Though he made no confession, they carried him to jail. No friends nor relations would go on his bail.
Dean from Oregon writes, Dear HAC, in a future podcast, could you mention the early history of the KKK, formed right after the Civil War? From what I understand, Satanist and Mason Albert Pike had something to do with forming the early KKK. Yet, on the other hand, General Nathan Bedford Forrest was the early leader of the KKK in order to protect Southern women from the depredations of the freed blacks and for other reasons. In my opinion, even though there were honest and good men involved, the reformulation of the Klan in the early 1920s was, for the most part, a Jew operation in order to create the kind of image of evil white people with all the Jew-attended media propaganda used since that time for the Jew agenda. This is de rigueur for the biological parasite to control all sides of the argument in order to maintain their sucker hold on the host. Many of the characters involved in the post-World War II Klan left much to be desired. Boy, Dean, you really do want me to go off into all kinds of long historical digressions here, don't you? Okay, the original Ku Klux Klan was founded on Christmas Eve of 1865 in a law office in Pulaski, Tennessee, by six men, most of whom were lawyers, oddly enough. Believe it or not, folks, there was a time in our history when being an attorney was actually an honorable profession. Basically, these young men were just back from the war, they were pissed off at having lost, they were bored, and they were probably at least half drunk on Christmas Eve. So they formed the Klan as a kind of secret society, and at first it was kind of a frat boy joke. They took to dressing up as ghosts in white robes and Halloween-type masks and hoods with tall conical headgear, and riding around the countryside at night scaring the bejesus out of the niggers. How exactly things then progressed from there, nobody really remembers, but by 1866, the KKK was known throughout the South as a force for resistance against the Union occupiers and the Reconstruction governments of the time. I've never heard of former Confederate General Albert Pike having anything in particular to do with the Klan, although I may be wrong there. You may recall that some months ago, I played a version of the song Dixie on here with the original Southern Nationalist and Confederate lyrics. Well, those lyrics were written by General Pike back in 1861 at the beginning of the war. I do know that Pike was something of an eccentric. For example, in his song lyrics to Dixie, there are a couple of lines that go, "Spurn no danger, shun no labor, lift up rifle, pike, and saber." Get the pun? So Pike was a bit of a humorist. It's also true that after the war, he settled in Charleston and later on in Washington, D.C., and got involved in all kinds of secret esoteric societies. Freemasonry, mystical stuff like that. Supposedly, he at one stage practiced ritual magic of some kind, but I don't know any of the details. Most of that 19th century occult stuff was pretty much humbug, and don't even get me started on Madame Blavatsky. I should also point out that, contrary to myth, the Ku Klux Klan was only one of many resistance organizations or societies in the South during that time, and actually not even the most powerful one. I'd say the ultimate Southern resistance movement was the Red Shirts in Mississippi and South Carolina. They wore bright red flannel shirts as kind of uniform and were almost like early stormtroopers. They were basically the muscle arm of the Democrat Party, which, lest we forget, was the party of white supremacy at the time and was almost up into living memory. Now, they were the ones who got Wade Hampton elected as governor of South Carolina in 1876 and threw the niggers and the carpetbaggers out. There were also groups like the Southern Cross in New Orleans and the Knights of the White Camellia in Louisiana and Texas. There was one case in Mississippi where one of these groups actually revived the Confederate Army and went out dealing with nigger trouble armed and wearing their old gray uniforms. Also, you should understand that there was no one Ku Klux Klan during the Reconstruction. They had the same problem we have today. One centralized organization can be infiltrated and broken up and prosecuted on conspiracy charges, so forth and so on. In 1867, there was a meeting in Nashville, Tennessee, where Klan members tried to create a hierarchical organization with local chapters eventually reporting to the national headquarters, but it didn't really work out. There is a legend that General Nathan Bedford Forrest was the secret national leader of the Klan, but that's not entirely accurate. He was a strong supporter, and he acted as a kind of a public spokesman on occasion, and there is a rumor that he was appointed the first imperial wizard, although that's never been verified. But the idea of a national organization never really got off the ground, partly for conspiratorial and legal reasons. And bear in mind that the South was under physical occupation at the time by federal troops and gangs of armed niggers controlled by the Freedmen's Bureau. And politics were controlled by what was called the Loyal Leagues, which were composed of northern carpetbaggers and southern traders called scalawags. It was also because communications and transportation in those days weren't what they are today, and it was a lot harder and more expensive for people to travel and confer together. They didn't have the telephone or the internet, and while there was a post office and Klansmen could write letters to one another, the Union occupation could and did intercept the mail, and writing out long letters dealing with illegal activity wasn't such a hot idea. Just like sending me long emails describing illegal activities isn't such a hot idea these days because of the virtual certainty of interception by today's Union occupation. Local KKK chapters and bands were highly independent. Basically, they just concentrated on cleaning up their own areas. That's a lesson we need to pick up on for later. It's true that former Confederate General George Gordon developed what was called the Prescript, which was a kind of a Klan political and ideological manual, but that never really caught on either. And it was really more of a novelty item than anything else. The Klan and all the other Southern resistance and guerrilla groups were mostly just concerned with getting the niggers and the carpetbaggers off their backs in their own local areas. Now, the 1920s Klan, or what's called the Second Era Klan, was founded in 1915 at Stone Mountain, Georgia, by a man named Colonel William Simmons. It was very largely influenced by the movie Birth of a Nation, which was directed by the famous D.W. Griffiths. Which movie, in turn, was based on a novel called The Klansman by Thomas Dixon. That movie was actually screened in the White House and got a favorable review from Woodrow Wilson, who said it was like writing history with lightning. The Second Era Klan started out as a fraternal order, but it ended up becoming a lot more overtly political than the first Reconstruction Klan had been. It didn't really get going until about 1921, when the first elements of modern liberalism were beginning to appear in our national life. The second KKK preached what they called Americanism and the purification of politics from the degenerate elements that were starting to appear and work their way up to positions of power within the system, with a heavy emphasis on racial values, anti-communism, and anti-Jewism, if you want to call it that. Despite a lot of crap that's been written by liberals on the subject, there was actually very little violence in the 1920s and a lot of politicking. There was a time when if you wanted to get elected in the South, you needed the KKK's endorsement. One good example is Senator Harry Byrd of West Virginia, who actually joined the Klan at one stage in his youth as a step towards advancement to political office. Some of you may have seen those photos of 50,000 robed Klansmen marching down the street in Washington, D.C. back then. At its peak in the mid-1920s, the organization claimed to have something like 4 or 5 million members, although that's probably exaggerated, but there's no way to tell. In many ways, it was kind of like a version of the Rotary Club, and it wasn't just restricted to the South. There were Klan chapters all over the country. The Third Era Klan basically covered the rise of the so-called civil rights movement back in the 1950s and the 1960s. And you're right, Dean, a lot of those left a great deal to be desired quality-wise, although there were some pretty good actual leaders in the early days, in the 50s and the early 60s, men like Sam Bowers and Robert Shelton. I won't get too far into that topic because, as I've said before, while I used to think that a lot of our character problems were something that was specific to our movement, down through the years I've changed my mind and I've come to the conclusion that those issues we have with nutty and dysfunctional and self-destructive behaviors are now endemic to the entire white race as a whole. In essence, the Jews have succeeded in their centuries-long quest to destroy the white man mentally and morally as a prelude to destroying him physically. And by this time, all white people are at least a little bit nuts and damaged. Right now, for all intents and purposes, there is no Klan left anymore in the South or anywhere else. I don't count these little outfits with a grand dragon and all the 15 members that are scattered all over here, there, and everywhere. I think Bob Miles put it best. The Klan was designed to be a submarine and not a battleship. The Klan had its inception as a genuine guerrilla movement of national resistance. And once it had achieved that goal by 1877, when the last federal troops were driven out of the South and power was returned to white hands, it had served its purpose. I personally have a lot of respect for some aspects of the 1920s revival, but I think in the long run it would have been better if we instead had some kind of American equivalent of one of the European movements. fascism or national socialism or the Falange or whatever, back when it still could have gotten some kind of mass support. Now, the Klan has always been essentially reactionary, devoted to preserving a status quo. And unfortunately, the status quo that the Klan wants to preserve is now long gone. Anyway, time for the second music break. There are a lot of songs and ballads that have come down to us from the old times about ghostly or demon lovers who appear to their true loves, or else they appear to human lovers who have betrayed them looking for revenge, that kind of thing. I actually played one of those a while back, one called She Moved Through the Fair from Ireland. Now, this song is a little bit longer than I usually play on this show, but if you listen to the words carefully and follow the story, it has a very definite eerie and creepy effect. It's called The Holland Handkerchief. This is Connie Dover.
My darling, my head feels sore. cried, "Get down, love, the hour is late. Get down, get down.
Got an email from Ben in Afghanistan. Dear HAC, obviously I'm not saying that the time is now. This is purely an academic question. Would you consider the current turmoil in France to be an example, or at least a shade of the balloon going up? It's not exactly food riots or open warfare on the streets, and I'm sure the protesters and rioters will eventually get bored and go home. But they are out there because the government is running out of money to pay for its social programs. Perhaps it's the first snowflake of a coming blizzard. Perhaps it'll all blow over in a couple of weeks. Just food for thought. Well, Ben, maybe, but I have never really bought into the idea that a lot of our people seem always to hope for, and that is that white Americans or white Canadians will ever come out into the streets in large numbers and do the mass protest thing like the French or the Iranians or whoever for any reason. It's not really in the character of the 21st century pale-faced biped to do such things. Part of that social engineering I talk about, sure, but in this case it's older than that. Whites who are approaching radicalism almost always do so through conservatism first, and conservatism is very hostile to the whole idea of marching in the streets and raising a ruckus. It's considered rude and uncouth. Refusal to march in the streets is a kind of snobbery with white people because this is seen as something that niggers and lefties and dirty bearded hippy dippies do. Good citizens voice their political views by going into a stupid little booth and pulling a lever, or nowadays by calling a right-wing Jew radio talk show host and bitching and moaning. Only scum march in the streets, while white people are so proud of the fact that they stay home and go to work and keep the whole show running, which, of course, is exactly what we need to stop doing, but most people don't see it that way. And this all goes back to the 60s, when most white Americans were really pissed off about the way the niggers and the hippy-dippies were always marching everywhere and yelling and hollering and burning American flags and getting on TV and interrupting Bonanza, criticizing the president, giving aid and comfort to the Viet Cong, disrupting the Democratic Convention in Chicago, things that were utterly shocking at the time. I think that's what a lot of younger people can't grasp. They grew up in the 80s or 90s when the Jews and the television and MTV and whatnot had completely destroyed the whole idea of normal, and the first generation of white kids were being allowed to grow up with virtually no moral compass and nothing resembling a set of ethics or patriotism or values. This didn't used to be the case. With my generation, the whole red, white, and blue Pat Boone and John Wayne thing was the standard. People who grew to maturity in the past 30 years or so of madness, I don't think can really comprehend just how completely shocking it was to the majority back then to see young people marching around in the streets and calling into question ideas and principles which, however stupid, most Americans simply accepted without question in those days. It has left a kind of a permanent scar on the white American psyche. I'll give you a hint as to how to understand almost everything that's happened in the past 30 years. It's all about the 60s. This whole conservative, liberal, red state, blue state, culture wars, liberation this and gay that and Rush Limbaugh and all the general yelling and sound and fury, it's because essentially our whole political and ruling class is still refighting the 60s. Now, the fact is that with the help of the Jews and the media, the dope-blowing, hippy-dippy, weatherman-type scum basically won. They succeeded in tearing everything down. And yet they weren't able to build anything in its place, and so now nobody really has anything other than material things, and they don't know what to do. The conservatives, on their part, are too stupid to realize that everything has been torn down, and that there is now nothing left to conserve. They're trying to conserve a past that no longer exists, and which wasn't all that much of a good thing when it did exist. Now, getting back to your question, though, Ben, I could be wrong on this, of course. It could be that something actually might trigger mass action, but it would have to be a kind of desperation that white Americans have never before known in their history. Even during the Great Depression itself, back in the 1930s, white Americans never revolted. Instead, they sold apples on the street corners and lived in hobo jungles and elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt 4 times so they could get his handouts. The French are marching in the streets these days in order to protest against the raising of the retirement age from 60 to, I don't even know what, 62 or something. But you have to understand that France has been a social democratic welfare state for almost 3 generations now. For those of you who don't know what that is, social democracy in the European sense is a kind of Marxism light. A little bit more easy on the secret police thing, unless you, of course, you're a Holocaust revisionist or a racially conscious white, and everybody gets a government check of some kind, child benefit or subsidized state housing or whatever. The French and most Europeans have gotten used to that, but now, as you accurately point out, Ben, there simply isn't any more money, and the French government has to find some way to increase income and cut spending. Now, that's what you always have to do when you get yourself in debt. But liberals and social democrats have never been able to wrap their minds around that fact. Now, this is happening all over Europe today, but could it ever happen in America or Canada? Again, I don't think so, at least not anytime soon. For one thing, white Americans, at any rate, have a pacifier that they can suck on in the form of the Tea Party. Once more, we've been sold this bill of goods that if we only go into the little booth and punch the right button on the little electronic machine, then everything will be all right. Now, don't get me wrong, I hope the Republicans do kick ass on Tuesday, but not because it's going to do any actual good. I just want to hear the liberals and the Democrats like Arianna Huffington and John Stewart and MoveOn.org and all those other lefty assholes scream and scream and scream, and I really look forward to hearing Rush Limbaugh rubbing it in on Wednesday morning. Now, that's fun, but it's not real politics. I don't know if there is any equivalent of the Tea Party in Canada, which is actually a lot more overtly socialist than America, but if not, there will be. When the rubber is going to hit the road in this country, and in Canada, will be when what is actually already starting to happen here occurs, when the government actually physically begins to run out of money. Now, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Now, for one thing, they've got a bit of a bailout of their own coming. On January the 1st, 2011, the United States is going to be looking at the biggest tax increase in its history, partly because many of the Bush tax cuts will expire on that date, and partly because of Obamacare and the need to pay for it, and partly because of various taxes that the Democrats have simply slipped through the system in the time since Barry was immaculated. White people in this country have been told this by Rush Limbaugh and some others, but I honestly don't think they understand yet just how bad it's going to be. Now, if I could digress into economics here for a bit, the real killer is going to be Obamacare. In addition to increased tax rates for all income brackets, the cash value of the health insurance provided by your employer will be added to your taxable gross income as a way to encourage you to quit and get onto Obamacare. So that's another $4,000 or $5,000 you'll have to pay taxes on. And that's a real refund killer for most people. I think Americans need to get used to the idea that after 2011, very few of us are ever going to see an income tax refund again. What's going to happen on January the 1st, 2011, is a financial catastrophe for those white families who do still contain a working adult, and God help you if you own or run a small business, because most of those cuts affected small businesses. Personal income tax rates will go through the roof, back to Lyndon Johnson era levels. The top income tax rate goes up to 40%, and this is also the rate at which two-thirds of small business profits will be taxed. The lowest rate will rise from 10 to 15%. All the rates in between will also rise. Itemized deductions and personal exemptions will be phased out, which has the same mathematical effect as higher tax rates. The marriage penalty will return from the first dollar of income. The child tax credit will be cut in half from $1,000 to $500 per child. The standard deduction will no longer be doubled for married couples. The dependent care and adoption tax credits will also be cut. Now, the big news is the return of the death tax. Death duties were an invention of the British socialists back in the 1940s to try and break Britain's aristocracy and capitalist classes by making it legally impossible for wealth to be passed on to one's children. The socialist idea being that capitalists are all lazy bums who inherited their money. Well, there's some truth to that. But in any case, it fails, since wealthy British people have managed to become the world's greatest tax evaders, mostly by simply leaving the country or else shipping their money offshore. That's nothing you have to bear in mind about taxation. The rich people are always going to find some way to evade paying taxes. And of course, the poor can't pay, so that leaves the middle class to get the shaft. In this country, for those dying on or after January the 1st, 2011, there is going to be a 55% top death tax rate on estates over $1 million. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean millionaires, you know. We're talking about net worth, and $1 million is no longer a lot in today's inflated real estate market. A person who dies leaving behind, say, two homes, a business, and a retirement account could easily get hit with a 55% death tax bill and have their loved ones forced into foreclosure to pay Obongo. I think of farmers who don't make much money, but their land, which they purchased years ago with after-tax dollars, is now worth a lot more money on paper. Their children will have to sell the farm, which may be their livelihood, just to pay the estate tax if they don't have the cash sitting around to pay. Think about your own family's assets. Maybe your family owns real estate, or a couple of houses, or a vacation home, or a business that doesn't make much money, but the building and the equipment are worth $1 million. Upon their death, if they own a home, stock, or land, or business, or farm equipment, or cash worth $1 million, then you're going to owe the government $525,000 in cash. Now, that's 55% of the value of the assets. Do you have that kind of cash sitting around waiting to pay the death tax? No, I'm not making this up. Yeah, all of this is submerged in a few thousand pages of crap from the IRS, but 55% estate tax whenever someone dies is what it boils down to. Now, how many of you understand that this is what's coming on January the 1st? And don't even get me started on Obamacare. Now, there are over 20 new or higher taxes in Obamacare, the first of which go into effect on January the 1st, 2011. They include the medicine cabinet tax. Now, thanks to Obamacare, Americans will no longer be able to use pre-tax health savings accounts or flexible spending accounts or health reimbursement plans to purchase non-prescription, over-the-counter medicines except for insulin. And this, by the way, includes my own diabetic testing strips. They'll go up to about $80 for a bottle of 50-meter strips, and I'm probably going to have to stop testing after January the 1st. And if you're so unfortunate as to have what the government euphemistically calls a special need child, you can no longer use any kind of private health insurance to pay for any kind of education. I'm not sure if that applies to blind kids or not, but I wouldn't put it past this government. The regime wants to completely take over that whole area of child and health care for sick and healthy kids alike. Remember, total state child care and child control is also a very big item on the socialist agenda. Now, all of this crushing new taxation will cause the remaining employed and middle-class white people to scream aloud in agony. But even then, I don't think they'll march in the streets unless you want to count these silly Tea Party dues. What they will do is what white people always do, look for some way to run away, to avoid confrontation with the system, to stay out of the system, to hide their wealth and their income and evade the taxes. Now, that's been the white man's way these past generations. It's how we've been conditioned to react to pressure or threat. Never stand up and resist because the state is too powerful and the big bad policeman might hurt you. And besides, standing up and resisting is not a white thing. Instead, you evade contact and find a way around the problem, not overcome it or force your way through it. Now, this is what I saw happening in Ireland, which had a maximum tax rate when I was there of 64%. Officially, the unemployment rate in the 80s was around 12 to 15%, and hundreds of thousands of people were drawing benefit, but almost everybody had a side job for cash going on, what they called a nixer. Almost everybody had two sources of income, a government welfare check of some kind, child benefit or dole or whatever, and most people were fairly happy. There was a lot of immigration, true, but most of the immigration was because young Irish people wanted to get out from under the thumb of the Catholic Church that still ran the country back in the 80s. They wanted to come and wallow in the flesh pots of America or London, meaning they wanted to get drunk, do drugs, dance like niggers in disco, and engage in promiscuous sex with anything with a pulse. I never got that. Dublin in the 1980s wasn't ginger man Dublin of the 1950s. Those kids could have done all those things just as well in Ireland. Sorry, I'm rambling again. Okay, look, I know, as always, I'm wandering way off the subject of Ben's question. The point I'm trying to make here is that this sudden rush of income to the government from this massive increase in taxation will, to some degree, take the pressure off for a bit. But the increased taxes will prevent the United States from running out of money right here and now. I don't know what the situation is in Canada. The regime is, in essence, killing the goose that lays the golden eggs, but they'll be able to feast on goose meat for a while until it runs out. So the great tipping or crashing point wherein the United States finally runs out of money is still a ways off. When that time arrives, probably in another couple of years, the regime has several choices, none of them good. They can try raising taxes yet again, and they probably will, but they'll find, as all socialist governments eventually find, that there's simply a limit to what can be collected that way. The people just get too damn good at evading taxation like that. I mean, look at the old Soviet Union. A black economy is created, and in time it becomes much bigger and more vibrant than the official economy. And that's what happened in the Soviet Union. After the last of the goose meat is gone, the regime will be out of money and desperate, and so they'll fall back on that old standby. Obongo will call up his Jewish friend Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, and the government will start to print money. This will lead to hyperinflation, as anyone who has ever taken Economics 101 could tell the people who are going to be doing it. And that's one of the few things that might actually get that balloon to finally go up. And it might even get white people to march in the streets, although they'll be doing so without a plan. Basically just a bunch of crybabies demanding to be given back their bottles. Now that's what makes the Northwest Front so much the better alternative. We actually have a plan and an objective. White people marching in the streets would be a very good thing. But white people marching in the streets here in Seattle and Portland and Vancouver demanding a free and independent white homeland in the Pacific Northwest is what we have to shoot for. Right, third Halloween edition music break. I don't think much of today's rock music, largely because it's gotten really filthy and degenerate. But even today, I have to admit, there do seem to be a few limits, one of which is no cannibalism. But back in the early 1970s, there was an actual cannibal rock song called Timothy that made a brief appearance on the top 40 before the lyrics actually sank in and people realized what it was about. Anyway, cannibalism was definitely over the top for those times, and this one came and went in a hurry. This is The Boys. Okay, I'm running long here, and I haven't even gotten into my weekly section on recruiting for the Northwest Front. I'm going to get into a subject or two right now, the kind I dread discussing, because I have to be very careful of the way in which I discuss it. Choose my words very carefully. If I don't, it sounds like I'm running certain people down and belittling them, and I don't intend any such thing. I'm not talking about any identifiable individual here. I'm discussing personnel problems like any personnel manager would. Guys, I say again, I'm trying to pass on to you 40 years of experience on my part so that when you go into your party work, you'll do so with all of that knowledge that I acquired at such a cost. But in order for me to do that, I have to be honest. I have to be practical. I have to be realistic, and I have to give it to you straight. I've been talking about how white nationalists who are trying to bring other white people around to our point of view can get in under the enemy's socially engineered radar and automatic racism rejection mechanisms and avoid tripping the automatic rejection reflex that most white people have had hardwired into their brains by decades of political correctness. This has to do with ordinary white people whom we are trying to convince and convert and spur to action, but that's not the only kind of recruit that, as a Northwest Front organizer, you'll be dealing with. Ideally, we should pick and choose our people, and no one should ever join the party. The party should join you. But realistically, given our web presence and eventually the fact that our activism will attract attention here in the Northwest, there are going to be people who come to us wanting to get involved, and you need to know how to assess potential volunteers, small v. The first thing you need to do is assess someone's potential value to the movement. Now, I've spoken about that before, but you also need to assess their character, and first and foremost, you need to understand precisely why they are voluntarily coming forward. Now, I'm not talking about potential spies and enemy agents. That's a whole nother subject. I'm talking right now about sincere white people who genuinely want to join in our efforts and become part of our movement. One of the first things a Northwest Front activist needs to ascertain is why. Broadly speaking, I'd say that probably the biggest human character problem we have as regards bringing in new people is that so many people come to us and seek to become involved in the movement because they want to get something out of it, not put something into it. And this being early 21st century America and not early 20th century Europe, we should hardly be surprised at this. White people who come forward and place themselves at the movement's service out of nothing more or less than pure idealism are going to be very few and far between, although we do get them, and they're the most desirable kind of recruit. If you run across one of these people, you got a real gem. But most people will want to get involved out of less pristine and much more human motives. Notice I said human motives, not necessarily bad ones, but you need to know what to look for and expect. I don't have to tell you guys how the media portrays us, especially how they portray National Socialists. We're violent homicidal maniacs who dress up in weird neo-Nazi uniforms and goose-step around in compounds way out in the woods that are full of automatic weapons. And we rob banks and armored cars. We engage in elaborate criminal conspiracies to assassinate the president or poison the reservoirs and ghettos with LSD. We have private torture chambers in our basements into which we abduct poor defenseless niggers and cute little Jewish kids in yarmulkes and gutsy, busty, beautiful female FBI agents whom we then do S&M with. You get the idea. You all need to understand that as ridiculous as this Hollywood Nazi image is, there are millions of our own people out there who actually believe it. And that means that there are going to be some people who will want to join us because of that very stereotype and not in spite of it. There are also people who read my books and who somehow get the idea that this is what's actually going on right now in the Northwest, that the NVA is real. And that when they join the Northwest Front, they're going to be handed a rifle or a pipe bomb and told to go kill somebody or blow something up. It reminds me of J.K.R. Rowling getting all those letters from children after she published the Harry Potter novels, and they wanted to know how to get to platform 9 3/4 because they wanted to go to Hogwarts. Now, that's the first thing you need to do when you're dealing with a potential recruit. You need to make sure that the prospect understands that this is a legal movement and that we don't break the law, at least not until there's no more law left to break. And you need to immediately stifle any wild talk on his part of illegal activity. Now, it's not necessarily just police agents who do that, you know. A lot of white people honestly, passionately want to join the NVA right away and start blasting. Like all Americans, they want it all, and they want it now, and they want it either free or really cheap and with a full warranty and guarantee. I wish to hell we could accommodate them, but we can't. Real life doesn't work that way. Another phenomenon we get a lot is people, usually single white men, but more recently some women as well, trying to join us because they're basically just looking for friends. Now, I get this. Believe me, I do. There is no one on earth more lonely and isolated than a racially conscious white person adrift in a seemingly endless night ocean of political correctness. It's a horrible way to live, and I think we've all been there at one time or another. After a while, you actually start questioning your own sanity. After all, you're the only one who seems to be aware of all these racial and political problems and all the contradictions, the tremendous gap which exists in America between what is said and what is done. You're the only one who seems to see all this insane crap going on everywhere, while everyone else around you seems to buy into it. Eventually, you start to wonder about your own sanity. After all, if everybody else believes that whales speak French at the bottom of the sea and a giant pig eats the moon every month, then who exactly are you to say any different? If everybody else believes all this malarkey about the races being equal and being gay is so wonderful and magical and funny and how we're all going to be coffee-colored in a number of generations and how the Jews are just wonderful little fiddlers on the roof, then maybe they're right and you're wrong. You start thinking to yourself that maybe you really are the one who's out of step. Maybe you are nuts, like the majority says you are. And then you go to the internet and you find VNN or Stormfront or a few other websites and you see that, no, you're not alone, that there really are others who see the same things that you see and feel the same things that you feel. And for a lot of our people, that's enough. They join a V-Bulletin board and they vent, they listen to podcasts like this one, and they feel better, and they're able to make it through another day. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's an understandable and human reaction. But eventually you want more. You get tired of the internet and you want to meet some other real-life activists, and that's fine too. I wish more people would feel that way. We have almost 2,200 people on our email list right now, and only about 140 of them so far are willing to list their names on the public email address list so they can contact and meet other people. I'll mention another thing. I notice that I often get queries from these single white men asking me if there are any white women involved with the NF. You would be amazed at how desperate so many of these guys are just to meet a racially conscious white woman. They're so rare. Most of them don't care what she looks like, just so long as he can say nigger around her and not get a lecture on tolerance and a threat to leave him and take the kids. I sure as hell wish I could accommodate them, and sometimes I can see their faces fall in disappointment when I have to tell them that single and accessible, racially conscious white women of childbearing age are, for all practical purposes, non-existent. Now, that's another thing we're going to have to change, although God knows how. And I don't blame them. There is not a damn thing wrong with wanting to find a wife. It shows the guy has healthy instincts. But your prospects need to understand from the beginning that the movement isn't a dating service. Let me make clear that all of this is not necessarily a bar to somebody becoming involved with the NF, just so long as you make it clear to them from the get-go what the real situation is. But we need to think, are these people really going to turn out to be Class A's in the kind of environment we have right now? The thing is that the party is not and cannot be a pen pal society or an internet club or a social networking site. We have Facebook for that. Let me tell you a little story. Some people ask me why I don't publish my phone number. Well, I'll tell you why. The last time I ran for public office was 20 years ago, in 1990, back in North Carolina, where I tried to ride David Duke's coattails into the State House. I had to withdraw from that campaign for a variety of reasons, including a deliberate act of sabotage on the part of the local board of elections in Wake County, typical dirty trick. But another reason that I had to withdraw was that I ran out of time to work on the campaign. You see, Dr. Ed Fields, who was at that time publishing the Truth at Last newspaper, decided that he wanted to give me a hand, and so he published an article on my campaign in his newspaper, which at that time had a circulation of something like 30,000 subscribers. Purely in the spirit of trying to help, he also published my phone number. That opened the floodgates. I would come in and find dozens of messages on my answering machine from all over the country, from Europe. Before I knew it, I was spending at least 8 to 10 hours on the phone every day, because people, mostly middle-aged to elderly men, were calling me who just wanted to chat. They were calling me because they were lonely, and they desperately wanted somebody to talk to. Again, I get it. I'm not saying this is wrong. It's completely human and understandable. But in a matter of weeks, I had to change my number. I was simply unable to get anything done because I was talking on the phone all the time to a bunch of lonely middle-aged men. And since they were more often than not the ones who were financially supporting the whole effort, I couldn't afford to be rude to them or not return their calls. This is why we need to set up some kind of general headquarters with some kind of staff or a duty officer like the old party had. I don't think it's at all unreasonable for our supporters to want to call the Northwest Front and talk about their work and get questions answered, but it's just not possible today for me to spend hours and hours on the phone any more than it was 20 years ago. Now, this is one reason why we always had a 24-hour duty officer at the old NSWPP headquarters. People used to call up the headquarters all the time just to yak to the duty officer, because they were so terribly lonely and isolated and surrounded by black and brown scum and liberals. And they just wanted to hear another National Socialist voice. When I first started doing desk duty at the old El Monte headquarters and later on at Franklin Road, it was explained to me that one of the duty officer's jobs was to talk to the supporters on the phone, soothe them, stroke them, and keep them out of Cale's hair so he could get his own work done. We had a whole raft of regular callers who were clearly calling not because they had any real party business, but because they were going out of their mind with loneliness and isolation from being surrounded by human garbage. I learned to talk to them, be polite to them, shoot the shit with them, and try and get them off the phone as quickly as I could without being rude to them so that they didn't tie up the line. I say yet again, there is nothing wrong with this motivation for joining the movement. It's only natural for people to want to communicate with their own kind. Now, if we can just find some way to translate this into actual relocation, although I think the Internet has kind of screwed us there. The Internet provides at least some sense of community for our people, and maybe that's a good thing. But if it satisfies people enough to keep them from moving into an actual white nationalist community, well, I won't go off on that again. The main thing that you have to decide, though, is realistically speaking, what use is a prospect going to be to us? Exactly what kind of people do we really need right now? I will tell you. We need lone wolves. We need strong, strong men of iron will and iron character, utterly dedicated and utterly determined, who can, if necessary, spend years at a time operating all alone out in the politically correct wilderness. If possible, we need people who don't need human contact, or who can do without it as much as possible, because there is so little of it in the life of a racial nationalist. Remember what I've told you before about reading John le Carré spy novels. We need people who have the nerves of steel and the power of mind over body and emotion to live and function for years as agents behind enemy lines. And in view of the fact that even the world's intelligence services have trouble locating and motivating and training, inserting that kind of individual and making them into effective assets, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that we do as well. Okay, I'm still not completely ranted out for this podcast. I have some more to say, but I've already been babbling for a good 10 minutes, so what the hell? Why not another Halloween music break? The Salem witchcraft trials of 1692 are one of the most fascinating episodes in America's history. I even used them for a section in my novel, The Stars in Their Path. There have been all kinds of liberal revisionists who have tried to seize hold of the Salem witchcraft and tried to interpret it in some kind of liberal or Marxist way, either claiming it was a land grab by certain wealthy families in Salem to accuse all their neighbors of witchcraft and then steal their farms, or else it was all some kind of male conspiracy to keep women in their place or whatever. That feminist bit always seemed especially silly to me because if you look at what actually happened, not only were some of the accused witches men, but all the accusers were this gang of teenage girls who started having epileptic fits and visions and claiming they were bewitched. I know times were different then, but surely those judges and lawyers couldn't have been that bloody stupid to believe a bunch of hysterical teeny boppers who were talking about seeing specters and yellow birds and magical cats and having orgies with the devil out in the woods, and this is Massachusetts in the winter, no less. I suppose if they were alive today, they'd be FBI agents and U.S. attorneys helping to frame Edgar Steele. But apparently that was the case for a while, although to be fair, it only took about 6 months for the authorities to come to their senses and call a halt. Anyway, there are no original folk songs about the Salem trials that I know of, possibly because while the Puritans had a lot of strong points, they weren't a very musical people. In fact, I'm not sure they sang at all, except maybe hymns in church, and maybe not even those. They probably thought singing in church was papist and sinful. Mostly, they were into sermons, a lot of which were printed up in Boston on those old presses in heavy black type with a lot of woodcuts, and which are some of the most boring drivel you will ever read. Sorry, I'm rambling like Grandpa Simpson here. This is a quasi-folk song about a Salem witch.
her shape upon the beam, so none could doubt 'twas there. The neighbors round swore to the truth of her satanic powers, that she could fly o'er land and stream and come dry shot through showers. At night 'twas said she had appeared, a cat of fearsome mien. Avoid she devil they had cried to keep their spirits clean.
Okay, I'm running way long, and so I'll wind this up now. I got a few responses to last week's request for some graphics for small items to hand out, and I also sent out the party's fall building campaign fund appeal letter, so hopefully we'll be able to raise some of the money necessary to print them up. I understand that one of the challenges we face now is to give people who are already here and who want to help something to do. We're trying. But we're not going to see much in the way of success until we actually get some more people physically here and get them organized into activity groups, at least the first trouble trios. This means that we're going to have to continue to rely on those lone wolves I mentioned earlier, and we do have more and more of those all around the Northwest. Progress is being made, people. Deadly slow, but it's being made. A lot of people say, "Give us something to do, Harold," when what they want is for everything to be provided. They want me to suddenly produce some secret guerrilla army I've been hiding out in the woods. I wish I could, but it's you guys who are going to have to provide the army. In my novels, I tried to show you what a finished product should look like and maybe will look like someday. But the real world is very different. There is, of course, no reason at all why we cannot eventually create the world I depict in my novels. But that world comes with a price, and it's one we aren't quite willing to pay yet. I just hope we don't leave it too late. Comrades, I know that the most infuriating thing about all this is that we're having to do now the basic laying of groundwork that should have been done 50 years ago. I've talked about this before, and so I won't go into it any further, but I will say this. It is what it is, and we have to accept the fact that our many predecessors dropped the ball. What's important is that we pick it up and run with it. We're not used to the kind of conspiratorial method that realistically we're going to have to use. We've never had to do it before in this country's history. Even at the best of times in our past, there has always been a certain amount of corruption and tyranny, but it was never as life-threatening as it is now, never existential. We're going to have to learn how to defeat it, and it can't be done with tea parties and Rotary Club tactics. We are dealing with an enemy who is absolutely without conscience and who has no qualms whatsoever about framing a 65-year-old man just out of heart surgery or imprisoning a young man for posting a poem to the internet or giving Matt Hale 40 years in prison for typing a single sentence in a chat room or firing 10 bullets into Jeff Hughes and walking away leaving him dead on the sidewalk. We are fighting against evil people. And evil can't be beaten by half measures or by angst-ridden dysfunctionals or by tapping out a blog on the internet. We need strong, strong men and women who can go to the distance, who can live and work and fight on their own out in the wilderness, who understand why they're doing so and who will never, ever give up. I know you're out there. Some of you are listening to me right now. To you I say, we're ready when you are. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom.
Beating perfect.